Hello, and welcome to the DeathCast. I'm your host, best-selling author and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our third look at the murder of Roy Ridden. As always, I have the normal show notes before we get into the case proper. If you would like to follow me on social media, just search for the DeathCast or Ian Totten Author. If you'd like to sign up for the show's mailing list, just go to CorpseCreekPublishing.com and click on the sign up button. If you'd like to help out with the show, consider leaving a 5-star review wherever it is you get your favorite podcasts and share the show on social media. Lastly, if you're interested in becoming a Patreon member of the show, you can go to tinyurl.com/DCPatreon. For as little as $2 a month, you can help support this show and help offset the production. I know there's a lot of you out there, so please consider becoming a Deathcaster or a Deathcasterette. You will get a shout-out on the show on a weekly basis. Alright, now that all of that is out of the way, get yourself something to drink, find a nice comfy chair, kick back, relax, close your eyes. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. When we left off last week, Roy Ridden had returned to New York City to look into his apartment, which had been burglarized. It was found, really, that a filing cabinet within his apartment that held business records had been broken into, and Ridden informed the hotel management where his offices were located that this break-in had occurred. Want to remind everyone that the majority of the information I am imparting to you comes from Bad Company by Steve Wick, which is the seminal book on the Roy Ridden murder. There are other sources I am using, such as newspaper clippings and archival news segments about this case. While Ridden is in New York, he sets up a meeting with Robert Evans. Unbeknownst to Ridden, Lainey and Robert Evans had rekindled their romantic relationship, and prior to flying out to meet with Ridden, the two of them headed down to Miami. So Evans has Lainey Jacobs in his ear, but more than that, he also has his brother Charles, who is warning Evans to back away from Roy Ridden, as he had looked into Ridden and found out about the charges that had been leveled against him concerning Melanie Holler. I've mentioned it in the previous two episodes. The Melanie Holler case continues to be something of a black eye for Hollywood, because there were so many accusations that she leveled against Ridden, along with those who were at the party. But it's more than that. It is believed that there's a possibility that Roy Ridden may have videotaped what took place at his home that evening, and that these videotapes had been circulated among Hollywood. Whether this is true or not, I have no way to know, but it's important to point out that that rumor is out there, and that people who were active within Hollywood during this period of time, to this day, refuse to talk about what happened to Melanie Holler. Evans was given this information, but it wasn't that simple, as he did owe individuals money, and he'd already begun talks with Mario Puzo, the author of The Godfather, to work on a script for the Cotton Club movie. But beyond that, Robert Evans was desperate to get back within the good graces of the Hollywood elite. And it seems as though he was willing to get in bed with anyone, no matter what their character was, in order to make that happen. So Evans and Jacobs are down in Florida, and they meet with Jacob's attorneys who tell him that, you know, there's a possibility that American Express, the credit card company, might be interested in getting into the movie business with Robert Evans. Evans saw this as an endgame because if he could get a corporation such as American Express, along with a few other individuals, to come in on the movie, then he could cut ties with Roy Raden and would no longer have the possible stigma of doing business with a man who had been accused of such a horrific sexual assault associated with his name. After this meeting with Laney's lawyers, it was decided that the two individuals would go up to New York with them to sit in on the meeting with Roy Raden. It's also been said that after this meeting, Robert Evans met Laney Jacobs' benefactor, Bella Chase, who, if you'll recall, is the suspected drug smuggler whom Laney Jacobs was getting her cocaine from. Some people have pointed out to me in messages that Bella Chase was not a suspected drug smuggler, that he was in fact a drug smuggler. I was unable to find any information or court documentation stating that he had ever been convicted for these crimes. So therefore, he is going to be referred to as an alleged drug smuggler because of that. While all of this is going on down in Miami, Raden is meeting with his godfather, Johnny Stapelli, who, if you'll recall, was a member of organized crime. He's giving him tips and pointers on how to deal with these individuals, and he may in fact have been working an angle so that he could get involved with the formation of this company as well, although this is purely speculation on my part, and I only bring it up as anyone who has ever had dealings with organized crime will tell you that they never do anything for free, and there's always an angle that they're working in an effort to try and get money. Evans and Raden ended up having their meeting, which went badly, with Roy Raden eventually storming out after roughly 30 minutes because it had been learned during this meeting that Laney Jacobs wanted half of Roy Raden's 45% stake in the company. But more than that, Robert Evans supported Laney Jacobs in this demand. Out of this meeting, Raden and Johnny Stapelli ended up going back to Robert Evans' townhouse. And instantly upon seeing Laney Jacobs and one of her lawyers, Stapelli decided that they did not need to be doing business with these individuals, which should tell you something, that a member of an organized crime family automatically knows when the individuals that they are going to get into bed with are bad news. They went on with the meeting, and Laney began to browbeat Roy Raden, who in turn told her that she did not even deserve to be there, and that in fact he was willing to pay her a flat finder's fee for connecting both he and Robert Evans. Now, according to some sources, after this meeting was finished with, Johnny Stapelli informed Raden that he would have nothing to do with business and drug dealers, and that Raden was on his own. And after this, Roy Raden is supposed to have told his personal assistant that he will have Laney Jacobs killed. On May 9th, Roy Raden and Jonathan Lawson returned to Los Angeles, with Lawson reiterating what Stapelli had told Raden the previous day, that they should not get into bed with any of these individuals, as it could only lead to trouble. Raden then stated that even though he had been talking about walking away from the deal, there was just too much at stake for him to be willing to walk away from it, which should give you an idea of both how desperate Raiden was to get into the movie business, seeing as his vaudeville interests were failing, and how clouded his judgment had become due to heavy cocaine usage. Raiden ended up meeting with Desmond Wilson again, during which period of time he's alleged to have told Wilson that he was working on a deal to become the next president of Paramount Pictures. Prior to this, it's alleged that Robert Evans had offered Roy Raiden a $2 million buyout of his share of the burgeoning company, which Raiden refused. Later that night, Raiden was out when Jonathan Lawson received a phone call at their hotel room, where a man that Lawson was unfamiliar with let it be known that Raiden was stepping out of line, that he had a very big mouth, and that he needed to back off or there would be trouble, that this was his first warning, and that the second warning would not be so pleasant. Upon being informed of this phone call, Raiden shrugged it off as merely a scare tactic on the part of Laney Jacobs, which Lawson realized was further evidence that his boss was losing connection from reality. Raiden ends up reaching out to Johnny Stapelli to inform him of the phone call. Stapelli, in turn, pleads with Raiden to return to New York, stating basically that these people are going to end up killing you if you don't get out of this, just cut your losses and return, which Raiden was having none of. A few days later, Laney Jacobs called into the hotel where Roy Raiden was staying, insisting upon having a meeting with him that night. This is where we discussed in the first episode how the plan to kill Roy Raiden actually began. Raiden learns about this. He gets all excited, thinking that, you know, maybe Laney is going to see reason. He's excited about it. He's also believing that he can outsmart her. Unbeknownst to Raiden, Jacobs was in the process of trying to sell her house in California because she rightly understood that what she was about to put into motion was going to bring heavy heat down on her. During the course of this day, Raiden has numerous meetings with Desmond Wilson, where they discuss the plan for the night, that he's going to go have this dinner with Laney Jacobs, who will be picking him up in a limousine, and that Desmond should follow them to the restaurant, which Raiden had chosen. And then, after he has this meeting with Jacobs, where basically Raiden is going to give her his demands and not take no for an answer, he will be leaving with Desmond. Unfortunately, that is not what happened. Raiden ends up getting into the limousine, and somewhere along the way, Desmond Wilson, who is coked up out of his mind, ends up losing the car. The limousine pulls over, and Jacobs gets out, after which the limousine drives off into the night. So the following day, there's a big panic over Roy Raiden. He's missing. Jonathan Lawson starts calling around. There's phone calls flying all over the place. Laney Jacobs insisted that the two of them had an argument and that she got out of the limousine, and she believed that Raiden ended up going on to the restaurant by himself before going out for the evening. What nobody knew is that Laney Jacobs friend slash bodyguard William Mensur had been putting together a hit team with one man to drive the limousine and Mensur and another man to actually carry out the hit. Here is what happened according to William Mensur. After Jacobs got out of the car, they continued driving with both Mensur and Bob Lowe, not to be confused with the actor Rob Lowe, pinning Roy Radin to the back seat of the limousine. Apparently, Radin was scared out of his mind. While they were driving, a police car came up behind them with its lights flashing, and all three men believed that they may have been caught, at which point Mensur took his gun and shoved it so forcefully into Raiden's mouth that it split his lips open and Raiden began bleeding profusely. When the cop car went by them, however, the two hired killers, Mensur and Lowe, relaxed and they continued on driving out on Highway 5. They drove out to a remote area in the canyons where it's said that Mensur went berserk and shot Raiden 27 times. There is more to that story, though. The two men basically beat Raiden up, demanding to know who had robbed Lainey Jacobs' house of the drugs. Obviously, Raiden knew nothing about this, and he began pleading for his life. Mensur, who had polished off a half bottle of wine, was hearing nothing of what Raiden was saying, though, as he had been sent there on a mission, and that mission was to make certain that Roy Raiden did not leave the canyon alive. After murdering Raiden, it was decided a couple of days later that Mensur, Marty, Lowe, Plazak, and Lainey Jacobs would be heading to Miami. As has been previously discussed, Jonathan Lawson was in the process of hiring a private investigator as well and getting Raiden's relatives in on trying to locate the man. Lawson would later state that he knew something was seriously wrong when his boss did not return, and that despite some people telling him that, you know, Roy had done these kinds of things before, just wait it out, he'll return, Lawson knew that it was more probable than not that his boss was not going to come back from the limo drive with Lainey Jacobs. Reportedly, while Jacobs was in Miami, she went and met with Bella Chase, and upon informing him that she had had Roy Raiden murdered, Bella Chase blew up, believing correctly that a murder investigation could have serious repercussions on his drug empire, which Lainey tried to assuage by telling him that there was no body, they would never find what was left of Roy Raiden, but apparently Bella Chase did not believe her. While back in Los Angeles, the private investigator that had been hired by Lawson conducted an interview with a friend of Lainey Jacobs who had become a Confederate. During this interview, the woman stated that Lainey Jacobs was a major drug trafficker and that it was her belief that Jacob's courier, a man by the name of Tally Rogers, had been behind the theft of the cocaine from Jacob's home. She also went on to talk about how Raiden had canceled a check to Lainey Jacobs right around this time and that this had infuriated Lainey. During the week after Raiden's disappearance, friends of his, who may or may not have had ties to the underworld, flew to Los Angeles to take over looking for Raiden. It was their belief that he was more probably than not dead, and they informed the local media of this. One of these individuals actually gave an interview stating that Raiden had been murdered and pointed his finger squarely at Lainey Jacobs. After giving this interview, the private investigator whom Roy Radin's friends had hired received a phone call letting him know, basically, your time is numbered, which led to the private investigator carrying a gun with him while he continued to work the Roy Radin case. Also during this week, one of Laney Jacobs' lawyers approached this private investigator, whose last name was O'Grady, and let him know that she would not be coming forthcoming with any information. And he also changed the story that Laney had been telling, stating that it was actually, in fact, Laney who had gotten out of the limousine. If you'll remember from the first episode, Jacobs was claiming to Jonathan Lawson that it was, in fact, Roy Radin who had gotten out of the limousine. She also claimed later to Lawson that she had gotten out of the limousine and that the limo had driven on with Radin. You can see she was jumbling her stories around. Thankfully, though, this private investigator, O'Grady, had his facts straight and informed the lawyer that she's continuously changing her story. She needs to pick one and stick with it. While all of this is going on down in Miami, two of the individuals who had been involved in the murder of Roy Radin got rid of the guns, which had been wrapped tightly in towels, by throwing them into a lake. A week on, we have all of this going on when Mark Fogel, who, if you'll remember, he was the owner of the car rental company that had been running drugs for Laney Jacobs out in Los Angeles, who had been popped. He's also the man who had given the limousine to Mensur & Co. to take care of Roy Radin. He starts putting two and two together and becomes scared, so he actually reaches out and contacts a friend of his within law enforcement and informs them that he believes that Roy Radin might have been murdered, but more than that, he believes that the limousine that he had lent to the men may have been involved. This individual from law enforcement then turns around and contacts the homicide department and lets them know of the information that he has learned. Supposedly, during this period of time, Robert Evans is alleged to have said to someone that he knew Laney Jacobs was a big-time drug dealer and that she had killed Roy Radin, along with implying that he would be next. If this is true or not is one of those things that cannot be confirmed, as Robert Evans, until his dying day, insisted that at the period of time when he began his relationship with Laney Jacobs, he did not know that she was involved in drug dealing and smuggling, believing her to have been a very wealthy divorcee. And it was only when she was arrested and put on trial that he became aware of her ties to the underworld. The disappearance of Roy Radin took a dramatic turn on June 10th. On that morning, a man by the name of Glenn Fisher was out near the town of Gorman, which is in the desert country northeast of Los Angeles. The man was hiking through the canyons when he came upon the bloated, decomposing body of a man dressed in a suit. He in turn contacts the Los Angeles Police Department, and by that afternoon, two detectives, Carlos Avila and Willie Ahn, arrived. It was noted that the man's body was positioned in such a way that it appeared that he was mimicking the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, with both arms outstretched, the head turned to the west, and the feet crossed at the ankles. Also noted was the fact that there appeared to be no jewelry on the body, and that the pockets on the suit had been turned out as though those who had killed the individual had robbed him after the fact. After the body had been removed, Detective Avila returned to the area with kind of a screen, and he began sifting through the sand and soil around where the body had been found, and roughly 7 feet from where the body was discovered, he found the lower mandible of a human jaw with some teeth. And he began putting together a picture of what had happened. It was his belief that the individual had been shot, and afterwards an explosive device of some type had been placed inside of the mouth in the hopes of destroying any evidence that might lead to the identification of the body. It was after this that the Los Angeles Police Department officially opened an investigation into the disappearance of Roy Radin. There was numerous reasons for this. A, the LAPD already had a file on it, and it had been moved to the jurisdiction of the sheriff's office. And B, the body that they had been found somewhat fit the description of Roy Radin. It's been alleged that upon learning of the news that Roy Radin's body had been discovered, Lainey Jacobs flew into a rage and began screaming over and over again that they weren't supposed to find the body, they weren't supposed to find the body. At Radin's eventual funeral, Red Buttons, the famous comedian, wrote the eulogy. There were very few people at Roy Radin's funeral because of the scandal with Melanie Holler that he had been involved with, as well as the manner of his demise. People within the entertainment industry did not want to get any of the stink of the life and death of Roy Radin on them. The eulogy that Buttons had written for Roy Radin is as follows, quote, "Henry Wadsworth Longfellow once said, 'We judge ourselves by what we feel capable of doing, while others judge us by what we have already done.' As far as I'm concerned, Roy Radin did a lot. He packed 100 years of living into 33 years of life, an envious accomplishment. This was the Roy Radin I knew. He had an excitement about him. There was always something happening, something doing, something playing. I knew Roy in all his shades, all his colors, all his moods. Yes, he was temperamental, brash, cocky, outrageous. Yes, he was compassionate, charitable, sentimental, lovable. He had the devil on one shoulder and an angel on the other, and for Roy it was a perpetual tug of war. Yes, he was Peck's bad boy, and yes, he was not dull. He had wit, he had style, he had class. He was generous to a fault. There was no picking up a check when you were out with Roy Radin, a vanishing breed in today's world of short arms and long pockets. At the incredible age of 17, when most kids are still hustling their parents for spending money, Roy started producing shows. It's hard for me to believe that when I met Roy, he was only 22 years old. He was an anchorism. When he was born, vaudeville was already long gone and forgotten, and yet he had this strong desire to relive this nostalgic era. That was the milieu he seemed to be most comfortable with. Roy had a deep and profound respect for performers who, in the twilight of their careers, found the going rough. His treatment of headliners long past their prime was a joy to behold. The affection and tenderness he displayed toward Georgie Jessel, as an example, was inspirational for all who were privy to witness it. Roy was enthusiastic. There was a boyish charm about his enthusiasm. It had an infectious quality. Roy had plans. So many plans. Always plans. He reminded me of a prize fighter in the gym, shadow boxing and chasing some elusive target. It saddens me to think of all the things he left undone. It came as no surprise to me when I learned he helped raise with love his three sisters, Katie, Lisa, and Diane. He loved his brother, Joel. Roy loved his mother, and he loved his father, Al. He loved Loretta, and he loved Tony. He adopted two children, who he dearly loved. That should tell you something about the man, and I sure hope God noticed that one. It came as no surprise to learn that Loy Raiden had played Santa Claus every Christmas Eve at an upstate orphanage. Roy loved kids. He was a big kid himself. He was flamboyant. He was fun. He was my friend, and I miss him already. The day following Raiden's funeral, he was buried in Southampton. The day after that, Jonathan Lawson fled the country to Spain, fearing for his life. It's at this point we are going to introduce another character by the name of Bill Ryder. If you remember my interview with Private Investigator Ed Opperman, he mentioned Bill Ryder as the man who stated that his guns had been used to murder Roy Raiden. Bill Ryder worked as the head of security for Larry Flynt, head of the Hustler Publishing Empire. It was Ryder who had hired Bill Mensah, Bob Lowe, and a man by the name of Alex Marty to work as security guards for Larry Flynt. According to Ryder, Mensah approached him and confided in him that he and the others had been involved in a hit, which he didn't believe. It wasn't until a few days later that Alex Marty began telling him the same story. Again, he didn't believe that they were telling him the truth until they brought newspaper clippings concerning the murder and discovery of Roy Raiden's body. And over the course of the summer, the two men continued to tell Ryder about their involvement in the murder, with Mensah claiming that Marty had gone completely berserk during the murder and had, in fact, emptied clip after clip into Raiden's body. When pressed for information about who had ordered the crimes, both men stated that Laney Jacobs and Robert Evans had ordered the hit. It should be noted, though, that Robert Evans, until his dying day, refuted this particular part of the story, and in fact stated that he had had no idea that Roy Raiden was going to be murdered by Laney Jacobs. It does give you something of a window into Marty and Mensah's mindsets, though, that they felt comfortable enough with the crime that they had committed that neither of them believed that they could be caught and so would freely talk about it with a fellow bodyguard. On the afternoon of September 19th, 1983, Bob Lowe was traveling from Miami to Los Angeles International Airport, where he was picked up by Bill Mensah. After driving from the airport, the two were quickly pulled over by narcotics agents who brought them back to the airport, at which point the two men were separated and Lowe gave consent to have his luggage searched, and it was found that Lowe's luggage was filled with cocaine. So now the officers have reason to hold both men, and they continue to question them, with the officers trying to get permission to search Mensah's apartment. Unbeknownst to them, however, was the real reason that they wanted to search this apartment. Information had come in linking Mensah's name to Roy Raiden's homicide, and they wanted to search the apartment to see if they could find anything that might tie the man to the murder of Raiden. After Mensah agreed with this, a search of his apartment was conducted. It was during this search that Detective Avila, who, if you'll remember, was assigned to the Roy Radin homicide, discovered two photographs of Mensah and two other individuals, one of them being Alex Marty, the other being Bill Ryder. The three of them were dressed in camouflage fatigues and were shooting guns. But the thing that Avila noticed about the pictures was the setting. It appeared from these pictures that the men were actually standing at the place where Roy Radin's body had been discovered. Also in Mensah's possession, they found a pink slip for a 1982 Cadillac that had been purchased from Mark Fogle by Karen Delane Jacobs. The title had been transferred to Robert Lowe on May 13th, 1983. It was a few days after this that Avila drove out to the area where Radin's body had been discovered with the pictures in tow, and was able to confirm to himself that these men had been in the area where this body had been found. Although at this point, they did not have enough information to move on either of them, nor on Laney Jacobs, who was in the process of trying to restructure her life. The discovery of Roy Radin's body had really thrown a monkey wrench in her relationship with Bella Chase, who was so enraged, he decided that she could no longer be trusted to run the drug empire they had built in Los Angeles. For her part, Laney returned to Florida and continued selling cocaine and smuggling it. So she's doing this and moving on with her life as though nothing would ever catch up to her. On May 3rd, 1984, William Mensah was on Sepulveda Boulevard in Van Nuys. Two individuals, a transvestite by the name of June Mincher and a man by the name of James Christian Pierce, walked out of a building only to be accosted by Mensah, who shot Pierce in the chest, after which Mensah turned his attention to Mensah and began shooting Mensah in the head. Laney Jacobs began dating a man by the name of Larry Greenberger. Greenberger had been raised in the central Florida town of Okeechobee. Greenberger was described as a really good man, down to earth. Some people called him a hick. He was a very intelligent man who, at some point in the 1970s, had moved from working in real estate into narcotics, and eventually was able to amass a small fortune from the sale and running of cocaine. Greenberger was said to be much different than most of the individuals within the drug trade, as he saw it only as a means to amass money. Many people have stated that he was not the murderous type or the violent type, which is very odd indeed for someone who is moving millions of dollars of cocaine every year. Greenberger ended up being arrested at least two times, and it's stated that it was at this point that he left the drug business, although there are some indications that this might not have been an actuality fact. It is known that Laney Jacobs was still working in the drug business at this period of time that she met Greenberger, and the two of them ended up becoming inseparable, with Greenberger eventually moving into her home in Miami. On September 3rd, 1984, the two of them flew to Las Vegas, where they were married. This was Laney Jacobs' sixth marriage. As you have seen with previous marriages, every time that she gets married, she's moving higher up in the drug hierarchy. This is why I stated it's not entirely apparent whether or not Greenberger had retired from the drug trade by this point. They ended up moving into a house that Greenberger owned in Okeechobee. It was a remodeled farmhouse. And it should be pointed out here that, like most of the individuals within this story, Greenberger had had prior dealings with the usage of cocaine, a habit that he had believed he had quit. However, with Lainey now in his life, he had gone back to using it. It is known that Lainey Jacobs informed her new husband at some point about Roy Radin's murder, although she distanced herself from the actual planning of the thing by stating someone else had had Roy Radin murdered. To anyone who met Lainey, she informed them that she was a clothing designer and an investor in the Susie Cream Cheese Boutiques. As with everything in Lainey's life, however, having everything was not enough. She wanted more. By 1985, she had begun concocting the idea of opening plastic surgery clinics, and she intended to finance these clinics with Greenberger's money, which began sort of a split between the two of them, as Greenberger was not at all interested in Lainey's plan to spend his money on these clinics. Eventually, she was able to convince him to at least help her set up an office in downtown Okeechobee, which was called the Center for Plastic Surgery. She still kept the idea that she wanted to expand this business. By 1985, Lainey had decided that she no longer liked her new husband's lawyer slash business partner, a man by the last name of Rubinio. Rubinio had helped get numerous individuals within Jacobs' sphere of influence off on cocaine charges, including Bill Menser out in Los Angeles. Well, this lawyer was partnered with Greenberger on a yacht, which was estimated at the time to be worth roughly $250,000. Lainey, as was so often the case with her, decided that she wanted all of it, so she began to accuse the man of mismanaging the boat, and eventually was able to convince her husband that he needed to just outright buy the boat from Rubinio. Eventually, the two men came to an agreement. That is, until one day when they came in to actually do the deed, and Rubinio found that Lainey had come along with Greenberger, along with two other men, one of whom was Menser. Greenberger, it's been stated, his hands were shaking when they walked in, and Rubinio knew at once that something was wrong with him. He began writing a letter to Rubinio, and basically what it said was, "Sign the boat over to me, or they will kill your wife and family." Rubinio, believing that he had a joke being played on him, laughed at this idea, at which point Lainey Jacobs began screaming at him at the top of her lungs that they're going to kill him and his entire family if he doesn't do it. At which point Greenberger led Lainey from the office, informing Menser that he needed to make certain the man signed the paperwork. After forcing Rubinio to sign over the boat to Lainey Jacobs and Greenberger, the two men, Menser and his cousin, Tom Markle, who was a Los Angeles County deputy sheriff, proceeded to rob Rubinio, taking a watch from his wrist as well as the keys to his Ferrari. That weekend, a cinder block was thrown through Ravinio's front window. Later that weekend, she began informing Greenberger that they needed to take care of Frank Ravinio, going so far as to have Mentzer contact the man and inform him that you need to sign over your Ferrari to us as well as all of your wife's jewelry. And a few days after this, Ravinio ended up signing over the Ferrari to Lainey Jacobs and Greenberger before going to some clients of his whom he knew could offer protection to him. So as with a lot of other cases, you can see that by this point in her life, Lainey Jacobs is beginning to spiral. Her desire to control others and to have everything is leading her to make rash, brash decisions that, were she not addled from cocaine usage, she probably would not be making. She had begun to see herself as untouchable by this point in time, and it's going to continue along this route as Lainey is eventually going to decide that, you know what, I just want access to my husband's money, and he's going to give it to me no matter what. By 1987, the Roy Radin murder case had really gone cold. But that's not to say that the detectives had given up any hope of ever breaking it. Detective Avila was eventually removed from the case, and two other officers were put onto it. And these two officers had begun looking into Lainey Jacobs, along with Bill Mentzer and Alex Marty. Eventually, the detectives were able to make contact with Mentzer's ex-wife, and through them, they learned that he was friends with a man by the name of Bob Lowe, along with another man by the name of Bill Ryder, and a private investigator. They also learned that Mentzer owned guns, and that Mentzer had instructed her not to ever divulge any information about him. When shown the photographs that Detective Avila had found in Mentzer's apartment back in 1983, this ex-wife was able to identify all three of the men inside of these pictures. They also learned that Mentzer had been going out with a woman by the name of Linda Jacobs, and that the one time she had mentioned this name to her ex-husband, he had blown up on her, screaming at her for mentioning Linda Jacobs' name on the telephone. But they learned more about Mentzer. They learned that he had run around with a guy by the name of Alex, and that this Alex individual had at one point threatened a man by the name of Mark Fogel. And it was because of all this information, the police began drawing lines between all of them and realizing that this Linda Jacobs was in fact Lainey Jacobs, and that she was kind of the head of this organization that all of these individuals were involved with. However, they still did not have enough to proceed with any charges. Eventually, though, they were able to track down Tally Rogers, and this was in May of 1987. Rogers was in prison for molesting the son of his, at that point, wife. So the officers from Los Angeles went to this prison and spoke with Rogers, who began his interview by stating, quote, "Let me say at the outset that I liked Roy. Liked him a lot. I feel bad for what happened to him. I honest to God do. He didn't deserve it. No way." Rogers then goes on to recount to the officers who Lainey Jacobs is, how he had met her in the early 1980s and begun running cocaine for her. he explained how the setup was that he would go and pick up kilos of cocaine from Bella Chase and then transfer them out to Los Angeles to Lainey Jacobs, and that during one of his visits out there, Lainey had informed him that she had met Mr. Robert Evans, and that Lainey had informed him at this particular time that she knew of at least 10 other individuals within Hollywood who were interested in laundering drug money into the movie industry to produce movies. He further explained that he would pick up the cocaine, drop it off, but that when Lainey's safe would become filled with money, he would clean it out and drive it up to San Francisco, where, as I've previously discussed, it would be laundered through various banks and businesses. Rogers then explained about how Jacobs had shortchanged him on a number of the trips that he had made for her, and that this is what had led to him stealing the cocaine and the money from her. After learning all of this information, detectives were able to track down Bill Ryder, who was living out in the Midwest, and he agreed to fly to California to discuss matters with the detectives. Ryder ended up taking the detectives out to the canyon where Roy Raden's body had been discovered, after which he informed them that both Menser and Alex Marty were killers. Quote, "I'm afraid of these guys. If they knew I was talking to you, they'd kill me and my family. They used to work for me when I worked for Larry Frint. They were security guards." He also informed the officers that on numerous occasions, both men had confided in him that they had, in fact, murdered Roy Raden, as well as the fact that Menser had apparently killed a transvestite and a friend of this individual, which we discussed earlier, before learning that Menser had used Ryder's gun in the commission of the murder of this transvestite and her friend. It was also through Ryder that these detectives learned that supposedly Robert Evans had been involved in ordering the hit on Roy Raden. Lainey Jacobs' marriage to Greenberger had continued to deteriorate since he had helped her to open the plastic surgery center in Okeechobee. Lainey had plans to open up a resort in Mexico where the wealthy and elite could go to have plastic surgery done, and her husband, who had vast sums of money in private bank accounts that were held in his name only, refused to allow her access to these funds or to even help her raise them so that she could proceed with this plan. On April 8, 1988, Bill Ryder contacted the LAPD and informed them that he was willing to help them in their case against Lainey Jacobs. He ended up turning over a .22 caliber Ruger semi-automatic pistol that had been fitted with a silencer, which, according to Ryder, was the gun that Menser had used to kill June Menser. If you'll remember, that's the transvestite that Menser had killed outside of the apartment building. Ballistics was able to match this gun to the killing, and this was really the major building block that would be used to take Lainey Jacobs into custody. As for Lainey, her marriage to Greenberger had continued to deteriorate as his drug habit had escalated quickly, with many stating that he had become estranged from his family and spent the majority of his time out at the farmhouse that he and Lainey owned. And it's been stated that Lainey did everything that she could to keep his family from getting into contact with him, as his family realized that something was wrong, they wanted to get involved. She would not allow them to come out to the farmhouse to see their son. On September 12th of 1988. Larry Greenberger is supposed to have gone to see his parents and stated that he had no idea what he was doing with Lainey Jacobs, after which he went home, smoked a joint, did a few lines of cocaine, and then shot himself in the head. However, on the official police report, it stated that the manner of death was consistent with a homicide, as the bullet that killed Larry Greenberger hit him beneath the left eye with a downward trajectory. Based on gunpowder residue evidence, it was determined that the gun had been held at a considerable distance from Larry Greenberger's head, which meant that he would not have been able to shoot himself with the weapon. And Lainey began, at this point, to believe that everyone who knew Larry suspected her of his murder, further driving a wedge between herself and her husband's family. And there was good reason to suspect that she had been involved with this. Because while all of the things were going on between Lainey and her husband, the police in Los Angeles had been using Bill Ryder to build evidence of murder against Lainey Jacobs. And they'd been doing this by having Ryder wear a wire when he talked to the various individuals that the police believed were involved in the murder of Roy Radin. One of these included Bill Mensah. And during one of these conversations, Ryder let it be known that he had an individual in Miami who may have worked for Mensah involving the burning down of a house, but also in a possible assassination attempt. This individual who Ryder mentioned was later determined to be Larry Greenberger. And this really threw the investigation in Los Angeles into turmoil, because they learned about Greenberger's murder and immediately put two and two together and realized that there's a very good chance that Lainey Jacobs, who is now being considered by Greenberger's family as well as Okeechobee law enforcement of committing the murder of her husband, she might flee the area. They set up another meeting with Ryder, as well as convinced the LA County District Attorney to write up a letter of arrest for Lainey Jacobs. While all of this is going on, they learned that Lainey Jacobs was removing large sums of money from Larry Greenberger's various hidden accounts. Lainey, for her part, was moving around fairly quickly, spending time in Denver, Colorado, as well as at various hotels in the Miami area. And Lainey Jacobs pretty much hung herself, as she wanted to go back into the house that she had shared with Greenberger, but in order to do this, she had to agree to being questioned by the Okeechobee Sheriff's Department. So on October 2nd, she flew back into Florida, landing in Orlando with her new lover and a friend. While Lainey is giving her account of what has happened with her husband, she is unaware of the fact that there are other people present at this meeting at the hotel, namely two officers from the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, who, as I stated, had gotten an arrest warrant from Lainey, and they had coordinated with the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. So Lainey gives her interview, stating that her husband had killed himself over a droopy eye. And she walks out of the room while her lover is being ushered inside. And as she's waiting out in the hallway, A man approaches her and hands her a piece of paper, which is an arrest warrant. The man said, "You are wanted in Los Angeles to answer charges in the 1983 murder of Roy Alexander Radin. I have a warrant for your arrest, Mrs. Greenberger." It's been stated that Lainey Jacobs then yelled out for her lawyer, screaming over and over again, "Oh my God, oh my God," as handcuffs were placed on her wrists and she was led from the hotel. Eventually, in 1992, Bill Menser and Alex Marty would be convicted of first-degree murder, along with numerous other crimes, and be sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole, while Lainey Jacobs was convicted of second-degree murder, and I believe she was given a life sentence, which she is still serving. It's interesting to note, however, that Lainey has managed to manipulate people on the outside world into creating a change.org petition to try and get herself out of prison. And I urge anyone who has listened to this series to go look at it and have yourself a nice chuckle. Very few people have signed the petition for this horrible human being, and in all likelihood, she will spend the rest of her life in prison and hopefully die there. Another small piece of information that is of interest concerning this case is tied in with the Son of Sam murders. For anyone who followed my coverage on that case, you're very aware of the investigative journalist Maury Terry, who did more than anyone else to put out the idea that the Son of Sam murders were conducted by a cult of which David Berkowitz was a member. Well, Maury Terry was out in Los Angeles in the mid-1980s trying to track down information on this cult known as the Process Church of the Final Judgment. And for some reason, Terry ended up out at the scene where Roy Radin had been murdered, and he climbed up into a nearby tree in an effort to get a better view of the scene, as he believed it might have been a cult murder. And while he was up inside of this tree, Terry found a Bible that had various passages outlined and highlighted inside of it. Well, it would turn out that this Bible belonged to Bill Menser, and that he had apparently read some of these Bible passages before Roy Radin was murdered. Again, just a small, interesting aside. Some people have claimed that Maury Terry had planted this Bible out in the tree, although no evidence exists to state that, whether that is true or not. I find it highly unlikely that Maury Terry, who was beyond obsessed with getting to the heart of the matter of the Son of Sam, would have gone to such lengths as to plant evidence in order to verify the veracity of the story that he was telling. There we have it, the murder of Roy Radin. I hope you have enjoyed this series. I will be back next week where we will begin covering another case. Until next time, if you like the show, please consider leaving a 5-star review wherever it is that you find your favorite podcasts and share the show on social media. The Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing. Until next time, stay morbid.